You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is David Hall. Good morning, David.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Good to have you. So the off-running way we start the show is, who are you? What do we need to know about you to start the conversation?
Sure.
or labels, whatever you want.
It's a super easy question. Yeah.
You came with your sense of humor, yes.
I did, and that hopefully will be seen throughout the interview. Boy, that's a tough one, and not because I don't know who I am, but I think I could probably spend an hour talking about things that are important to me and what makes up me. So I feel like I'm...
And you will.
Yeah.
But where do we start?
So who am I? I've been an Ithacan for over 20 years. I work at Cornell Cooperative Extension, and I will go beyond the job thing in a second, but I work with kids. I've been working with kids for all of my adult life, and I tend to make decisions that I feel reflect my values and the kind of world that I want to see or envision. And so that means that I spend a lot of time in nature, and I try to keep the people in my lives connected with nature. And I try to manifest, I guess, the things that I value, you know, so I make
choices.
What are
some of those values?
Well, you know, we live in a very technologically oriented world, and I see the benefits, but I also see the very real drawbacks of that. And so I'm very conscious in my own life in the use of those things, how they affect me, not only positively, but more importantly, negatively. Mm-hmm. And it's not an antidote, but I realize that when I am in nature and I am calm and I'm being purposefully in an environment, that it helps me. And I also see that it helps others when they're in that place too.
So the image that I'm getting is that being, when we are in our usual environments, we're too close to technology, and being thrown into nature strips that away so we can have a little more immediate relationship.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I, you know, I work in the Dryden School District, and I work with, I have to work with about a 50%, you know, in quotes, targeted group, meaning youth have some sort of significant problem in their lives. And in almost every respect, kids and adults as well, but the youth that I work with just seem to feel better, perform better, meaning they're more compassionate, they unwind, they seem more comfortable in their own skin, more comfortable around friends as well as new people, and it gives them a place to be where they're not under the thumb of the school system, and they're away from technology.
And like many animals, they're not in a cage.
Yeah,
you know, at
Agreed.
That time. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, that's neat.
Yeah,
you brought some music with you too.
Yeah, I did.
And we're going to start with the Allman Brothers, and Don't Want You No More. You want to say anything about this before we play?
Yeah, and this has no reflection on you or my wife or anything. But I figured if it's the Allman Brothers, who I'm a huge fan of, this was a song that they would often open with. So I figure if it's good enough for the Allman Brothers, it's good enough for me to open with. So
okay, here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is David Hall. So, David, what experience or what kinds of reflection have you had on your life that have kind of helped to shape the person you are? What things triggered you to have the values that you do and to be working in nature and being drawn to it?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I went to a Boy Scout meeting the other night, and I admitted to them that it really, in so many ways, my connection to nature and my draw, at least for initially to adventure in the outdoors, was because of the Boy Scouts, which is kind of funny because I sometimes bust on the Boy Scouts. But really, my leader was this just wonderful, fantastic guy who I think, you know, he had a heart of gold, and he took us camping every week, or not every week, every month. Mm-hmm. And then every summer we would go on an extended excursion into the Algonquin wilderness.
Oh, wow.
Where you would literally be paddling past moose and hearing loons and sometimes hearing wolves cry. And there's something really, really, I guess, important about that, that mm-hmm. it just gets in you. And when I look back, there were those moments where my buddies and I would be up in Canada doing this later in life on our own as high schoolers. And it was like, what an important thing. You know, we're out in this wilderness where you literally could have been, you know, if something had gone wrong, there was no getting you out of there, you
right,
know,
right?
Because it would have taken 3 days to get back to a ranger station. And if you were bleeding and you needed help immediately, well, you know, it's humbling.
Right.
And it's really something else to wake up in August and everything's covered in frost and you've run out of food because you're a kind of a ditzy 17-year-old and you forgot that, oh, you're going to be out an extra day or two. And you have to live with the repercussions of your choices or your lack of planning.
Mm-hmm.
But just the fact that you're out traveling from lake to lake and seeing otter and, you know, and so that was one of them, you know, just being introduced to a world that was outside of the norm, you know, the mm-hmm. suburban life that I grew up in. And even then, despite being in suburban Buffalo, I was still very interested in nature, and we would find those pockets of woodland and we would go fishing at the local creek. So even though it was limited, we still found those places that mm-hmm. I guess fed us in a way. You
right.
know? So that was at least one thing.
Right. I mean, and what I hear in your story is it's when facing nature in that kind of raw way that you are at risk, you can either approach it with curiosity and reverence, or you can approach it with fear, and in the negative sense of, I mean, the scouting seems to have had that positive impact on you, and there's something about his personality that helped to make that transition.
Yeah, it was funny. I was saying, when we first started going up to Algonquin, you know, it's basically a canoe park. There was no instruction on how to paddle. There was no, like, try the J stroke, try this or that. He really just knew we'd figure it out, you know?
Right, right.
And that, I think, as a metaphor, was really a great thing to learn. It's like, well, you know, if you want to go sideways and back and forth in life, there's one way. Or you can ask how what you're doing is affecting your goal.
Right. Right.
And correct it, you know, and take right. charge of it.
Right, right. And you can figure it out.
Yeah.
Which is the confidence in the person.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that must be a tremendous gift that you can then give the students you work with, because somebody had confidence in you without giving you all. I mean, we have parenting in many ways these days is over preparing kids mm-hmm. for things that they don't have to discover, which they would own them with more confidence
yeah.
and hope and trust, which is confidence.
Oh, for sure.
If they figured them out on their own in many instances.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to train everybody.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of times, for example, yeah, and you're absolutely right. You know, my program will be trying to make a fire with a friction device.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I won't tell them how to use it. I'll just say, here, make fire.
Yeah.
And they kind of get it in theory, and they fumble, and then an older student will say, no, you got those parts backwards, or finally, you know, through some gumption and trial and error, they'll get it, uh-huh. you know, and that's kind of a neat thing. So with, like, very little help, they do it, because oftentimes there's a reward at the end, like chocolate or something.
Right, right,
you
right,
know, it's,
right.
Yeah.
And that also reminds me of my days in scouting, because mm-hmm. that was, you know, when you got your camp set up and you had your meal, the meal was a wonderful reward for mm-hmm. getting the fire going and getting everything
right
together. yeah. Okay. So as you have lived this quality, how have you had to learn to change or adapt it for different settings? Because this is, you're talking about kind of a modern day version of a little bit of a frontiersman with a lot more safety nets.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a little bit of a, how do you invite the students into your way of being? Because it could be, it's liberating once they buy in, mm-hmm. but a lot of people don't know how to do that.
Yeah, you're right. Well, it's interesting because my work, which, you know, is very nature-based. I don't do just nature-based programming out in Dryden, but that's where, you know, Primitive Pursuits had its humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's kind of like this idea of coyote mentoring. You know it's inherently good for students. You also know that they may have some apprehension, mm-hmm. some fears, some unwillingness to try new things, but you have to pay attention to each individual student and kind of find where they're at and then give them a little shove mm-hmm. past that edge.
Right.
And then assuming that, you know, you've done that and you've done that effectively, you're finding what gets them hooked, right? Mm-hmm. So for each student, that may be a different thing. I have one student, for example, who is totally into owls and raptors. She's training to be a falconer. That's easy. I'm preaching to the choir with her.
Right, right.
She's hooked. And
you know it.
And I know it.
But you didn't know it from the beginning.
I didn't know it from the beginning. And then, for example, though, I have some new students. And so I'm getting to know them. So we're kind of working on the fundamentals. And we've been working on a huge winter brush-covered shelter so that we can retreat and have a place out of the wind and have a little campfire for warmth. And I'm finding that they're really into cooking already. Mm-hmm. You know, in just a couple meetings, I'm like, okay, these guys are motivated by, you know, something over the fire to eat. And so that's great. But if I say, well, I got something today to cook, but we can't eat it unless you guys pick up a Bodril kit and figure it out, right? So they may not initially want to put the energy into learning a friction fire device, but they're motivated by having s'mores or
right.
something, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, and then eventually they realize, like, this is just fun. This mm-hmm. is cool, and it makes me feel so much better and different than, say, the bulk of my school experience.
Right, yeah. Right. And how do you, what can they take, given the nature of school, what can they reasonably take to help them go back into a school environment?
That's a great question. and the reason I'm laughing is because I'm not sure. I'd really be curious to ask some of my students if, well, I'll have to say this. I have had parents tell me that looking forward to my after school programs has helped their child get through the day.
Right. Right.
But I don't know if what I do helps them perform better or cope better if they're one of those kids who has trouble, say, sitting still, or they just don't fit into that paradigm very well. Because I don't want to be that person, you know, who, well, I hope it helps them cope, because mm-hmm. in some ways it ideally does give them a place to help be centered. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it can help them be more self-reflective. But that's a great question. But I, anecdotally, I've heard that, you know, it's helping get my kid through the day when mm-hmm. they otherwise were just like freaking out or getting into trouble or, you know, ending up in detention and or going home and not doing anything positive. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to survey my kids.
Yeah. Well, and what I'm, you know, I'm one of the things that kids do with electronic devices is they play with them, whereas us older adults tend to want to know what the rules are mm-hmm. and how to operate them rather than just start playing with them. Mm-hmm. But this is my own experience when I was in scouting or in Mikose, which was an honor, like Order of the Arrow out mm-hmm. here. You're taught to listen to the environment and listen for animals and listen for mm-hmm. and look for footprints and look for different kinds of vegetation mm-hmm. and listen to people and listen to things. So I would take that into the classroom and I would start observing the teacher like an animal, you know, so mm-hmm. what are their inflections? And I wouldn't just listen to what they were saying because I mm-hmm. might go to sleep, you know, that might not keep me my attention, but it might matter as much how they were saying what they were saying mm-hmm. as what they were saying. Or I might look at the book in a different way. When you start taking responsibility for how you look at the bow and the friction that you're creating with the, you know, to start the fire, then you're going to look at, you know, how you're playing with your pencil.
Yeah.
You know, that's my guess, but I don't know. But yeah. That might not be a conscious reflection.
Well, you know, and one of the things that I hope I accomplish is helping them to become better observers and ultimately more aware of and those are skills that transfer to any environment, not just the natural world.
Right.
You know, so you say to yourself, what is that bird doing and why? What's the bigger story here? And you read into it and you realize that there's this whole tapestry going on around you, this whole like fabric of drama that is constantly unfolding and rewriting itself. And so, you know, I think that, you know, it can train a part of you that then can apply that to a youth or a teacher, right? Because I'll see a kid who maybe seems to be having trouble, and I know that there's something behind the reason they're acting in an antisocial way, or they're depressed, or maybe they're acting out, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's how it manifests, but at the same time, you know there's something more, right? And then as you get to know that person, or you get to know their story or their family, you realize, okay, maybe there's addiction in that family. Maybe they're not getting the fundamental things that they need to feel safe. Maybe they're not feeling like they belong or have a community, right? There's any number of things that can be part of that. But usually when you see like a behavior that isn't desirable, that's just like the outward thing. Mm-hmm, but what's going on is much deeper, you know?
Right. And it kind of comes back to when kids who are acting out, it's a lot driven by fear or judgment and anxiety. And learning how to turn that, as you do, to curiosity, that can make it a way to engage without picking a fight.
Yeah.
My younger brother had he cut a deal with the school principal, let him come to school on the days that there were tests, as long as he kept B's or better in his scores. And then he went and farmed. This would never happen these days, but this was back in the 70s in a rural school in Missouri. But he finished high school because he got to go out and raise hogs and cattle and farm most of the day, and just come in long enough to make sure he had the assignments and turned in the work. And that kept him focused.
Yeah,
because he could really multitask well.
Right,
and it just completely shut him down to be in the classroom.
Yeah. And it's funny. You see all kinds. I mean, every kid has their story.
Yeah.
Some kids love school, but the majority, I think, they exist well enough in that environment. And then there's that bottom percent that it's like, oh, this is just horrible for me. Yeah. And I was one of those kids, so I really sympathize with that, you know.
How was it horrible for you?
Well, you know, I think I did fine in elementary school. I was pretty good, but junior high, okay, but high school was a bear. I went to a private parochial school, and I rebelled in a sense because I didn't like that I was being forced to read whatever I was being forced to read. I did enjoy A Clockwork Orange. That was fun. I didn't want to read things like, you know, A Midsummer Night's Dream. It was like it didn't speak to me. I didn't want it. And I didn't cheat. A lot of my fellow students cheated, and it was obvious, and I knew it. And I wasn't that person. I was like, if I'm going to do it, I'll do it because it's important to me, which didn't necessarily work out well academically, but it did force me to start thinking about who am I, what's important to me. You know, and when you're 14 or 15, I can admit that was not doing that in healthy ways. Right. You know, I wasn't saying, I'd rather read this book. Is there options? I just didn't do it. I just blew it off.
And you wouldn't know to do it.
Yeah.
A book, and the system in general does not say at every age you need to consent to what you're willing to learn.
Yeah.
And that quality of giving our consent, which seems to be what you draw out of people in primitive pursuits, you know, you choose what you learn, and you choose to learn from what you have done or not.
Right.
And once you're hooked, it's all over. You're all in.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and that hook didn't happen for you in high school.
No, it didn't. But that's okay, because, you know, in some ways I feel like it I took it seriously at some point, and mm-hmm. it made me personally say, well, what is important and why?
And you had to own yourself.
Yeah.
And people who are grouchy and uncooperative are oftentimes struggling with who they're going to own.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not be getting a lot of help from the environment about what could make that good. And I'm not sure if we help them by showing them, because discovering it on your own means you own it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And if we're not afraid of conflict, if we're not afraid of a certain amount of just banging heads together, which I think, you know, in a natural environment, we see that. That's mm-hmm. that kind of friction and conflict is inherent.
Yeah. 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 No. And yeah, I was just thinking of my poor parents who were so sweet and just trying to help this, you know, my high school, situation work for me. Mm-hmm. And they're very kind people in that way. And, you know, and I was just not buying into it.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? And yeah. and they were just like, oh, you know, they're helping get a tutor and trying to find plans and make charts. And I'm sure if my father listens to it, he'll laugh because he always laughs about the charts, those charts, you know, or whatever the plan was. And I just wasn't bought in.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
So it was funny.
And that is your fundamental human right.
Yeah.
Is to choose when you buy in or not. And yeah. It's hard to accept as a parent sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think this may be a time to cut to subdivisions.
Oh, perfect tune, right?
And do you want to do any introduction or comment afterwards?
Well, yeah, I would say, yeah, of all the songs here, this, when I found Rush, which was back in high school or junior high, I found a band that not only musically I felt was really putting some effort into being careful and really beautiful with their music, but then Neil Peart's lyrics, once he got beyond the sci-fi fantasy stuff, really spoke to a lot of people on an intellectual level, and they were just very honest and well-written lyrics. And so Subdivisions, you know, being that song about what the suburban experience for a lot of kids spoke to me.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Good. Well, let's listen to it. Or at least part of it.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is David Hall. So, David, what have you had to let go of? What have you had to give up to kind of live the life that you have most wanted to live?
So I grew up in a very involved Roman Catholic family, and it was, when I say involved, my parents were both Eucharistic ministers, my mom was in charge of the education program. Dad was a lector. So it wasn't just like we went every week. It was like
they were
really involved. Yes, yeah, yes. They were leaders within that context. And so thus it was just presumed that, you know, Sunday church was the norm, going to the religious ed was the norm. Mm-hmm. And there's these rites of passage that are part of that religion. And one of them was the confirmation process,
sure,
which comes when you're 13, 14, something like that. And as I already said, you know, in my high school years, I began to question somewhat consciously and somewhat unconsciously, what kind of person am I? Mm-hmm, what kind of person do I want to be? What do I believe in? What's true? What's not true? And I really had to think about this process, because it wasn't that when I thought about it, I knew I was a non-believer from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
It was never, as soon as I consciously said, do I believe any of this? It was like, well, no, mm-hmm, I don't, mm-hmm, you know? And so being the person that I was, I would lay in bed awake at night trying to just run through that conversation. How is this going to go? Knowing that we weren't just in a casual household when it came to these matters. Mm-hmm. And I started to survey my peers who were also in the church, you know, because I went to a Catholic high school. So I had lots of people, basically everybody, all my friends at school were Roman Catholic as well. So I'd be like, are you going to get confirmed?
Right.
And I would ask them why not? And the overwhelming majority said, well, if I don't, I'll disappoint my parents.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because I really believe
right,
in the Eucharist
right,
or I believe this or that. It was really like they didn't want to disappoint their parents. And of course, I didn't want to disappoint my parents either, but the idea of not being truthful was more important to adhere to me.
Right.
You know, so it was like this awkward thing because I was dragging my feet and I didn't know how to breach the subject with them, because there wasn't an out in that culture to say, what if you don't want to do it? There wasn't that
right,
option, right? And so at one point, we're visiting my grandparents in Syracuse, and my dad and I were out in the driveway. He's like, you know, your grandfather would make a great sponsor. You know, part of the process mm-hmm, is having a sponsor. And I looked at him and I just said, I can't get confirmed. I'm not going to get confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like a big old something hit the fan. It wasn't aggressive. It wasn't anger at first, but it was just like they had no mental, mm-hmm, they had never mentally even thought that could have been a possibility.
And that would have normally happened around 12 or 13.
Yeah.
Was that how old
about,
you were?
Yeah, something yeah, like that.
And that's the kickoff to your high school experience.
Yeah, right. Off I go to parochial school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was.
So what was the reaction? What was the reaction? Well, what was your response?
It was the response, and I think we were leaving that day to go back to Buffalo, was utter silence. Utter mm-hmm. silence, because they were, my interpretation was now as they were in utter shock.
Yeah.
You know, and it came out eventually in very angry ways. I remember my father getting angry at me and saying very arrogant things, sort of, you know, like just not knowing how to deal with it. Me getting angry, putting my fist through the door, literally, kind of thing. Eventually, I mean, over lots of time, I don't know if they quite understood me exactly, but mm-hmm. they accepted it, you know.
Right.
And, you know, they even have the family priest over who honestly was not any help.
Right.
Well, he had nothing to offer.
What was the anger about?
On their end or mine?
Both.
I'd have to ask them what their anger was about. If it was just my non-compliance, were they disappointed? Was it awkward for them? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've sort of had conversations with them over the years about it, but generally it's not something we go to a lot because it's sort of at a certain point, it just, they kind of shut down a little bit. On my end, it was feeling like it was unfair that I was being made to feel like I'd done something wrong when I knew I hadn't. Right. I was just being honest.
Right.
You know, and so when I'm trying to explain myself or trying to find myself and I'm not getting support, and then, you know, and at that point being not ridiculed, but just feeling like this sucks.
Yeah.
That's tough for a 13, 14-year-old, you know, and you don't have the tools or the maturity to do anything but put your fist through the wall, you know. I mean, grown up a little bit since then.
Yeah.
It
sounds like, well, just given both your work and your story, you're a physical learner. Hmm. You know, you learn by doing.
Yeah.
And that means you're also going to process a lot of stuff physically that other people might do otherwise. And people have physical reactions when their worlds are pulled out from under them. Hmm. I was once at a deathbed where a person whose sibling had died, and they wanted to beat things.
Mm.
They wanted to physically attack things. And we talked about how do you take all of the energy of having lost the person who you wanted to be in life with, and where do you put it?
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it goes into anger or violence, or suicide, which is another form of the anger and violence in some instances.
Yeah.
So how do you walk people down from that, having lost their universe? And you wanted to claim a universe they were going to withhold from you because it didn't make sense to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's funny because any number of these rituals are supposed to be like a rite of passage, right?
Sure.
And I stepped away from their version of rite of passage, but it wasn't so very long ago that I realized they gave me more of a rite of passage than they ever could have hoped for because I became me. And if I hadn't done that, I would have been living a life of regret and a lie. So to live truthfully, you know, was
And so the rite of passage is, I mean, it's wonderful that you use that phrase, because rituals take a person or a community from one condition and they help them to come to another condition that they would not have gotten to otherwise.
Yeah.
There are lots and lots of ways that this can mess up, but it seems like you held relationship to each other even when you didn't agree with each other.
Yeah, wasn't without awkwardness.
No. It wasn't probably without loudness and fighting and some pushing your hand through the door. I mean, and all of that is drama, and it's not optional.
Mm-hmm.
Rites of passage are almost always dramatic. I mean, the Eucharist is about the blood and body, because to live, we as human beings eat plants and animals, you know, and we need them to restore our bodies, and we give thanks for that fact. And we also live based on the ability of other human beings to sacrifice their lives for our well-being through jobs and all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes on a whole lot of possible meanings, and not just just one. And mm-hmm. where I think we get tied up in knots and where we kind of lose sight is when we speak, when we can speak of reality as we know it, mm-hmm. as opposed to for reality. Mm. People who are church leaders or scientists often fall into the arrogant trap of speaking for reality rather than of it. Hmm. When you speak mm-hmm. of it, it's beyond your comprehension and control because it is about something which is huge mm-hmm. that you have to engage and figure your way through. Mm-hmm. But when you speak for it, it's almost like mm-hmm. you own it, and that's not true.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
not true for the scientist, and that's not true for the religious leader. Mm-hmm. And in religious terms, it's taken God's place, which is arrogant and idolatrous. Mm-hmm. And in secular terms, it's talking, saying more than you can possibly know.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah.
And so yeah. so I can see the drama, and it seems that you've come out of it with compassion.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah,
I find it a fascinating topic,
and you are the first person, not the first, but very few people describe it as been fun. What's made it fun?
I love challenges. I really do. I do not back away from conflict.
Yeah.
Because you know, part of it is that I cannot think of an instance where I had to enter into, you know, in quotes, conflict with somebody where it didn't work out for the better of mm-hmm. both of us, mm-hmm. right? Because if you avoid conflict, you have all this unresolved stuff which can wreak chaos on your psyche, and it doesn't help
and
to
contaminate
remediate
your relationships.
Yes, exactly. So I'm the type of person, if I have a beef with somebody, I say, hey, this is bothering me. You did this. I don't know what's going on. We need to talk, because I don't like that feeling of having something unresolved that's important to me.
Yeah.
You know, and so in a way I enjoy it. I really do. And I've learned that it's valuable, you know, and it's when I don't let things go, but when there's something, if I wake up and that thing is still bothering me, I know it's real and I have to talk to my wife or talk to a friend about it and say, you know, that bothered me, or we need to figure out something here. And I cannot think of an instance where that wasn't worthwhile, you know?
Right.
So it's kind of like, it's just part of being an adult.
It's part of being an adult, but in order to do it, you have to be mature enough to be graceful with your own internal upheaval mm-hmm. and graceful with the upheaval going on in the other person, or you'll provoke a pissing match.
Yeah, right.
Of some sort.
Yeah.
And so how is it that you have learned to observe in yourself and the other what it takes to not get stuck?
Yeah. Well, you know, for example, my wife and I mean, we love each other dearly. If there is a beef, sometimes I know it's not going to get talked about tonight because it's too close to the moment, whatever the conflict was.
And too close
was.
To the bone.
Yeah. And I'll let it set for a day or two. And then we can both talk about it without so much emotion. It'd be like, you know, that was a little weird, whatever happened, or you know, we had something. And so it's like knowing when to approach versus like sometimes approaching right away is too soon.
Right.
People are too revved up, you know. Yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, I've been known to be a little bit of a Wolverine. When something's really bothering me, I'll be just like in somebody's face, which isn't always the best thing.
No, no.
And I've learned to back off from that and know better. As I've gotten older, I know better, you know.
Right. And it took me 20 to 30 years to kind of come to terms with myself, because I'm not afraid of the Wolverines or the Grizzlies. You know, it's just kind of where I live on some level. Mm-hmm. But not everybody has a stomach for that.
Yeah.
And there's a respect for that needs to be in place, but there's also a peaceful acceptance that you can enter into the space, find the productiveness in it, go through the emotional gyrations that it invariably brings, because mm-hmm. it's honest.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And come out on the other end.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a funny kind of transition, but you, what about Sugar Magnolia?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, actually going back, Sugar Magnolia, I picked because I'm a big Deadhead. I love the Grateful Dead. And this song is not by far my favorite Dead tune, but whenever I hear it, I think of my buddies growing up. And I mean, I grew up in suburban outside of Buffalo in Amherst, New York, Williamsville.
And 80s.
Yeah, and my buddy Don, I can't help but smile when I hear this song and think of all my buddies. There were five of us or so, and he was teaching us the lyrics to Sugar Magnolia while we're paddling down some Algonquin lake, and we're learning it and singing it like these goofy, gangly 15-year-olds, whatever, you know. And yeah, it has a sweet spot in my heart, yeah, just because it really makes me think of my buddies who I am still friends with, you know, after all these years. So
and nature is both a place of awe, which is a fear and wonder. And okay, you're having comic relief.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty and I don't care.
Saw my baby down by the river,
knew she'd have to come up soon for air.
Sweet blossom, come on, under the willow, we can have high times if you look back. We can discover the wonders of nature,
rolling in the rushes down by the riverside. She's got everything delightful. She's got everything I need. Takes the wheel when I'm seeing double. Pays my ticket when I speed.
She comes skimming through rays of violet. She can wait in a drop of dew. She don't come and I don't follow. Waste backstage while I sing to you.
But she can dance a Cajun rhythm.
Jump like a widow's in four-wheel drive.
She's a summer love in the spring, fall, and winter.
She can make happy any man alive. Sugar magnolia, ringing that bluebird, caught up in sunlight. Go down singing, I'll walk in the sunshine. Come on, honey, come along with me.
She's got everything delightful. She's got everything I need. A breeze in the pines in the summer night, moonlight, crazy in the sunlight, missing me.
Sometimes when the cuckoo's crying, when the moon is halfway down, sometimes when the night is dying, I take me out and I wander around. I wander around. Sunshine daydream.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and David Hall is our guest on this hour. So, David, from what you've described, a sense of having, maintaining your personal rudder, your personal integrity is really, really very powerful. And I think it does tend to make us really strong learners. And when we're people who have a big in relationship with the physical environment, we are big actors. What was this movie that I was watching where complete honesty or integrity in that sense is oftentimes not helpful, but knowing when to pull back or knowing when to just let it sit for a while or knowing timing or knowing shading.
Mm-hmm.
How have you had to learn to be kind? Because you describe having gone through a rite of passage, which was kind of harrowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think back to my younger self, and I think I had a level of arrogance that has softened mm-hmm. a bit. Mm-hmm. I think I'm still somewhat arrogant and overconfident, but that's okay. I can live with that. But I feel like back in the day, I had more of a know-it-all attitude. And, you know, I've really come to realize that, yeah, I can't be 17 anymore, and I have to... kindness is better, and compassion, and just how do you learn that, you know?
Right.
I think, you know, at some point it's a continuation of an envisioning of the kind of world you want to help manifest. Mm-hmm. And if I'm being a jerk, that's not helping, you know?
Right, right. And I think there's also a transition with age. You know, optimism is, and I think many times kids are more optimistic than they are confident because they think they've got it figured out.
Mm.
And optimism is a bet that you got it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas confidence is trust and hope that you can figure it out.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Because you've been worn down a few times. And in the middle of that word confidence is fi, which is faith.
Yeah.
Which is traditional definition is hope and trust.
Yeah.
And as you get older, it moves from trying to be certain to trying to be trusting. So and it's not, and it may or may not be arrogance, but it may be boldness.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it is arrogance, and sometimes boldness can come off as arrogance to people who are insecure.
Yeah.
And it's really tough to know where we are coming from, because mm-hmm. it can be too much for one and not enough for another. And the relational yeah. stuff.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, and I think, and this is just a construct of age, I've become more sensitive to individuals,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, it's like, oh, that person's coming into the room and they seem a little whatever, and I think I've become much better at disarming people in a way that helps them feel comfortable, you know? I mean, especially with the kids I work with, but right. adults as well. Right. I feel like generally I do a pretty good job of that.
Right. And this is lead into the last question.
Mm.
How do you know when you need to either disarm or reconnect yourself? What do you do to restore your sense of balance, your you know, your intellectual capacity, emotional mm-hmm. Facility, your physical, sensorial ability? What do you do on a daily, weekly, monthly, regular basis to kind of take care of yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, as much as I try to kind of maintain sanity, you know, a certain level of comfort that I like to be organized, and I like to not feel overwhelmed. Like, but despite trying, life has a way of putting one too many things on you at certain
sure.
points. But what I do as often as I can, and as often as life, I guess, allows, is literally be by myself in the woods. And I'm not talking about going on a hike. I'm talking about, I may not move 50 yards. I mean, but I literally go into the woods. I try to be quiet. And I open up my senses fully. And this is when, even if I have just a half hour, sometimes it's worth it. And obviously, mm-hmm. if I have more time, the more possibilities can happen. But typically, I will go out, I'll be quiet. And it's something about really just opening up your eyes and your ears and your, you know, trying to just take in all the information that you can and get a big picture of what's going on can be really empowering. And it can be very magical. It's like, oh, that's when the fox trots by, or mm-hmm. I read into the bird language and I realize that a predator is coming through, or the buck allows me to approach and I can just sit and he doesn't care,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's something about that which reinforces how my own energy plays into drawing or repelling not only animals, but people away,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
so by being calm of mind and calm of body, really,
and can, heart, yeah. a non-threatening presence.
Yep, can really it just it's can be night and day, you know, how that affects. So that's one thing I do,
mm-hmm.
and that's just like if I had nothing else to do, I would go and mm-hmm. do mm-hmm. that. The other thing is, and this is like something I can do at home, is if I'm feeling a little stressed or feeling like, oh, I just need to unwind. I'm not a great guitar player, but I'll put on some music and I'll try to play along to it mm-hmm. and I'll learn fingering. And something about music is just, it uses the other side of the brain and it can be such a great tonic and I feel better afterwards, you know, and it's kind of like, well, I can't get out in the woods, but I can do this for myself, you know? And I think being very purposeful and deliberate helps me because I have things that I stand for, things that I believe in, and I know how to, for the most part, help manifest them, you know, being just deliberate in life and making choices that I think supports the person that I want to be. Yeah.
What do you notice in yourself when you need to take a time out?
Yeah.
How do you, what do you, is there a pattern or?
Yeah. I notice that my mind starts to whirl. I'm just harried and, you know, it manifests by being impatient. I'm actually less effective at my job or less patient, say, with my children or my wife, you know, and those are places you don't want to be. And usually it's like, oh, it's a work thing. And like, four too many things have just sort of come together at once. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, the database needs doing. This report has to be done and I don't have enough time to do it. So I'll make choices and I'll be like, I'm going to finish that at home on the weekend so that I can gain some sanity. You know, and it's really a state of mind, you know, that I need to manage. But yeah, and sometimes you choose not to do things too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've turned down some lecturing gigs simply because I know it'll be too much and I don't want to go to that place in my head. I don't want too much to do because it's not healthy for me.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. When did you learn that you needed to take care of yourself like that in this way? What happened?
I think, I don't know. I kind of think college because I'm not the kind of person who can wait until the night before to finish up my paper because I recognize that when I did that, I felt harried, frenzied, stressed, etc. So I was the type of person who learned that early on and I would get my work done. And I did fine in college, you know, I was into things, but that's when I learned that. I was like, oh, I much rather deal with it way ahead of time and continue to feel centered and okay and not stressed. So that's where that started, you know, and I even back then I found solace in nature. I would go on walks and I had a kayak and I'd go paddle on the Genesee River and all that good stuff, you know, and just find my time out in nature to kind of decompress, you know?
And how have you discussed or shared with your personal discipline with your children or with the students you work with?
I don't know if I've discussed it so much as just
modeled it.
Try to model it. Yeah, it's like try not to lecture at them, but see me as somebody to hopefully be worthwhile. A worthwhile person in their life to emulate in at least certain ways, you know, like
right,
that.
Right. And I guess what I kind of had in mind was somewhere between the two, where there's kind of a narration of what we're doing sometimes that helps people understand what they've seen but not really known why.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not lecturing. It's kind of being a parallel play or kind of next to each other in a way where that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that would be something that might give context to some of your students after they've gotten hooked.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've had this said to me many times, not just by students, but by faculty at the school, because I'm so different. I am not saying you need to prepare for the big test coming up. You know, have this paper. And I actually have the latitude to be present and be a mentor in that kid's life, you know, and really inquire and care and check up on them. And I chide them and they love it. You know what I mean? And
we have a real relationship.
We have a genuine relationship, which I think as the school climate changes, you know, teachers don't have as much of that space any longer. Mm-hmm, so I feel really proud of that. And that's part of what keeps me doing what I do because I feel like it's important and it feeds me as well as my participants. Yeah.
Right. So, and I want to ask one last question that may or may not want. I mean, how has your son's rites of passage come? Because in this day and age, it can come earlier or they can come later. We've extended childhood to about the age of 30 in many
yes,
respects.
We have.
But we hit things with kids much earlier in some ways that they're not ready to deal with.
Yeah.
So how do you feel your relationship with their rite of passage?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. That is actually something for my older son. I feel like we provided something. You must know Aziz. You know Aziz?
Yeah,
Jacob did a program with Aziz where they kind of met every week, and eventually they did an overnight experience, a solo. And Jacob, you know, he hit a wall that went not just to an edge, he went over the edge. He had a genuine panic attack being alone in this little wilderness. And I'm like, wow. You know, he wasn't harmed by that, but talking some of the kids, it was like kind of a casual experience, but he hit a place where it was like he really got to an edge and then went over it and found his way back to camp because he needed comfort.
He saw the coming unglued, but he also could get back to
camp. And so whether he was ready for it or not, it's what it is. Yeah. But I have alluded to him, and I have plans to actually give him another experience. Not necessarily an overnight, but something where he will be by himself in a wilderness. We will join up, you know, and we're going to, the two of us will have time together. And that's coming up fairly soon.
In his choice.
He has some choice, you know, but some reluctance too.
Right. And that's the adolescent coming of age stories are replete with, there's a structure. There are some choices and there are some things about which you just have to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's finding the balance and having the trust to go through them with either a father or another, you know, another same gender, usually adult.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's coming up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, David, it has been really good to get to know you.
Yeah. This has been fun. Thank you.
And we're going to close with an album that came out when I was in college. Steely Dan's From Can't Buy a Thrill. Only a Fool Would Say That. Do you wanna?
Oh, it's just me being silly picking this song.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah, that's a great tune. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Talking about a world where all is free. It just